is unraveling around us in many ways. When you look at the situation in Europe, you look at the economic situation, if you noticed, of course, the oldest investment bank in really in the world, the oldest British investment bank, Baring Brothers, has collapsed as a result of speculation. Baring Brothers has a connection with this area because Baring Brothers are the ones that actually financed and paid for the Louisiana Purchase. The United States government at that time didn't have nearly the money that was involved, and Baring Brothers is actually the one that financed the Louisiana Purchase. They go back a long, long time, and it just is indicative of the state of things that are happening in the world today. In terms of economics, the American dollar has dropped against virtually all the foreign currencies, except for the Mexican peso, which has dropped even further. It is just a situation that when you look at the world economy, things are in very precarious circumstances. When you look at the situation as it exists in Europe, in the Balkan area in particular, it remains a tinderbox. It remains a powder keg. You know, it's interesting that at the beginning of this century, the Balkans was called the powder keg of Europe. And so we've come, you know, almost 100 years down the road, and what do we find? They're still fighting in the Balkans. It is a powder keg. It is a powder keg because of the connections and the alliances that many of those countries have with other places. It is a very unstable world in which we live. You know, just a short time ago, it was peace, peace. Oh, we have peace in our time because now the Soviet Union is no longer the Soviet Union. They're the Russians, and they're all, you know, nice, good Democrats, and everybody's going to live happily ever after. And, of course, that has not been the case. You can, of course, go over to Chechnya, and you could ask people over there as to what nice people they are. And you've been watching it on the news or seeing it on television news or seeing it in the newspapers. We live in a very unstable world. Unstable economically, unstable politically. We live in a world that is on a crisis edge. Now, I'm not saying that these things are going to culminate within a matter of days or weeks or months, but there is a pressure that is building. And it is going to culminate, and it is going to come to a time of crisis, and it's going to come to a time of crisis in the lifetime of most of us sitting right here. And the Bible talks about that time of crisis, and without what is revealed in this book, no one can make sense of what is happening in the world today and where it's going to lead and the kind of world that our children and grandchildren are going to inhabit. If you get rid of this book, because you see, God says in Isaiah 46 that He declares the end from the beginning. God knew where things were headed. And He has a great master plan. We're told, as the Apostle Paul stated in Acts 17, that God has made of one blood all nations that on the face of the earth do dwell. And He is before determined the bounds of their habitation. You know, the times and the seasons of their power, their rise and fall. You know, that's made very plain as Paul brings it out there in Acts chapter 17. As he was talking to the Athenians there on Mars Hill. And he says that God has determined the times before appointed, the bounds of their habitation. There's a great time plan. There's a great master plan. Daniel. In the book of Daniel, Nebuchadnezzar was the recipient of a certain vision. He heard a voice, you know. He was filled with pride about great Babylon that he had built. He had a dream originally. And that dream showed him actually going insane. He was very troubled. Daniel interpreted the dream. And he told him that the purpose was that he might learn that the Most High rules in the kingdoms of men and gives them to whomsoever he will, sometimes even the basest of men. God overrules. And he is the one that determines the times, the bounds of their habitation, the times before appointed, the bounds of their habitation. When the disciples, right prior to Christ's ascension into heaven, when they asked Jesus if he would right at that time restore the kingdom to Israel, he told them, it's not for you to know the times and the seasons which the Father has reserved into his own power. In Acts chapter 1 and verse 7. The Father has reserved the times and the seasons. There is a plan that is being worked out. There was a season that was marked by the rise of Israelite power, by the restoration of the birthright blessings. And then ultimately by the passing of those blessings. We're in a time when the blessings that God has given to our nation, to the nations of Israel, as a result of His promises to Abraham, those blessings are being removed. And they're being removed because of disobedience. The more we have prospered, the more we as a nation have sinned against God and have forgotten God, have gotten further and further away from God's laws and God's ways. So we live in a tumultuous world. We live in a world that's coming apart at the seams. We can see it in our own communities, and we can see it when we look around the world. But brethren, the world we're living in can be made sense of because this book, the Bible, makes sense of it. Out of this crisis, out of this chaos, out of all of these things that are going on right now, there is going to emerge a system centered in Europe that will present itself and be presented to the world as the answer, the solution. There will be an individual who will be acknowledged as the Savior in a time of crisis. You know, in the book of Revelation, we read of 10 kings or 10 powerful rulers who will give their power to the beast for a short time. Now, I've given sermons before, and I don't want to go back for the sake of time and rehearse everything in terms of the beast power. But I think you understand that the symbolism in the book of Revelation actually originated in the book of Daniel. And, you know, there are those that think that the book of Revelation is just sort of some vague book and all of this. But God declares the end from the beginning. And the whole purpose of the book of Revelation was given that, as it says in Revelation 1:1, this is the revelation of Jesus Christ, which God gave unto him to show unto his servants things which must shortly come to pass. Well, these are things that are going to come to pass. These are real events. So John bore record of the Word of God, verse 2, and of the testimony of Jesus Christ, and of all the things that he saw. So there were three things that John recorded. The words of God, the testimony of Jesus Christ, and the things that he saw. And John then began to go through. Some of these things were visions that he saw. Some of it was revelation, direct revelation of God, and some of it was quoting Jesus Christ in the first person, things that Christ himself said. And it ties in. You go back to the book of Daniel, and originally in Daniel 2, you read how Nebuchadnezzar had a vision, had a dream, and he saw this great image, this colossal statue. And it was an unusual statue because the head was of gold and the shoulders and the chest were of silver and the thighs were of brass and the legs were of iron and the feet were a combination of iron and potter's clay. And as he was having this vision, this dream, a stone of supernatural origin came down from the sky and smashed the image on its toes. It hit it on its feet, and when it did, the whole thing turned to dust and blew away. And the stone became a great, huge mountain. Nebuchadnezzar woke up and he couldn't figure out what this was all about. you'd had a dream like that, you couldn't have figured out what it was all about either. Neither could I. Well, Nebuchadnezzar tried to figure it out, and he didn't know, and none of his associates knew. In fact, he wouldn't tell them. Either he couldn't remember the details, or else he wanted to check them out. You know, he was a little suspicious, and so he wanted them to tell him what it meant, and they couldn't. And said, "Well, if you'll tell us the dream, we'll interpret it." And he said, "Well," he says, "if God were going to inspire you with the interpretation, He could inspire you to know what I dreamed. And if I tell it to you, how do I know you won't just make up something?" So he was getting pretty frustrated and ready to chop all their heads off. You go through Daniel, and Nebuchadnezzar was ready to throw a fit every now and then. And Daniel heard about this, and Daniel realized his name was going. He was going to be on the hit list too. So he requested an audience with the king, came in, and prayed to God, and interpreted the dream. And he says, "You, Nebuchadnezzar, you, O king, you're a great king of kings, you're a great ruler. You are this head of gold. After you, another kingdom will arise." And of course, as you go through the book of Daniel, you find that the kingdom of the Medes and the Persians arose. And then we come on down, and there were, that there was yet a third kingdom of brass, which was, of course, Alexander the Great's Greek Empire that conquered the Persians. And then finally, a fourth kingdom of iron, the Roman Empire, which swallowed up all the others. And the Roman Empire came on down in its latter history in two divisions, the Eastern Roman Empire and the Western Roman Empire, which, of course, were symbolized by the two legs. And finally, the ten toes, the feet of iron and miry clay, the ten toes, a combination that comes together that represents the final version, the final form of the Roman Empire that brings back together East and West once again. That is what is destroyed by Christ at His coming. And so when back in the book of Revelation you read about these ten kings, of course, Daniel's image had ten toes. Now, on over in Daniel 7, Daniel saw a counterpart vision that consisted of creatures, animals coming up out of the sea. And he saw a lion, and he saw a bear, and he saw a four-headed leopard, and then he saw this great, terrible beast with iron teeth. And again, when you go through the details of it there in Daniel, in the book of Daniel, you find that again, it follows down the same pattern, these same four kingdoms, this time symbolized not by metals, but by animals. When we come back to the book of Revelation, we find that John picked up and utilized the symbolism Daniel had used, but viewing it from a little different perspective, because now we're almost 600 years downstream from the time Daniel recorded these visions. So much of what to Daniel was future events, by the time Revelation was written, those were past events. The Babylonians, the Persians, the Greeks, that was ancient history by the time John wrote. You know, sometimes we don't think of it that way. We think, well, they were all in Bible times. Well, Bible times stretched over thousands of years. For that matter, we're in Bible times today. But the times during which the Bible was being written stretched over quite an extended period of time, about 1,500 years from the time of Moses to the time of John. A lot of things happened in that period of time. By the time John was writing, much of what Daniel had recorded as prophecy had already become history. And so John picks it up and he describes it in a little different form. Instead of focusing in on each beast as separate, he focuses on it as one system, you know, that had the seven heads, the Babylonian head, the Persian head, the four Greek heads, and then the final head that represented the Roman Empire, which was the head that was extant, the only one that was still there when John was writing. But you see, really, it was still a continuation of the Babylonian system. The Babylonian economic, political, military, religious system that went all the way back to Nimrod and the Tower of Babel. The attempt of man to oppress his fellow man to build some great world-ruling empire based on the devil's way. And a continuation of the old Babylonian mystery religion that had gone through various stages of development, periods of throughout its history, but it essentially was still the same. And you can look around in our society, in our culture. I'll guarantee you the holidays, most of the holidays that are celebrated, the great big holidays that are celebrated would not be unfamiliar, and the trappings connected with them would not be unfamiliar to the ancient Romans, and they wouldn't be unfamiliar all the way back to the ancient Babylonians. You know, they used different names. They didn't say Christmas. They said Saturnalia. Maybe they pronounced it a little differently than we do, but they would have understood, you see. They would have recognized all of the... they would have recognized the essentials that were there, the time, and the events that were connected with it. And the events that we're going into right now, you know, into this period called Lent. Well, you can read about it back in the book of Ezekiel and Jeremiah. It's called the time of weeping for Tammuz, which was the ancient custom, you see, that started way back in ancient Babylon. And that coming right on through. And, of course, Lent leads up to Easter. We spell it the way we pronounce it, Easter. The spelling, if you transliterate it from the Babylonian, is Ishtar, I-S-H-T-A-R, but they pronounced it the same way. You know, that's where our word Easter comes from. It's not a whole lot new. You know, Solomon said, "That which has been is that which shall be." And so we find there is a continuation of these customs. Now, in the sermonette, Mr. McGahey was focusing on the fact that the Sabbath is a sign. It is a sign of obedience. And we went through and looked at the sign, a mark, a flag, a beacon. It is something that identifies. And, you know, that's always, of course, the case. That's what flags are for. You know, one of the... a lot of publicity has been given in recent times because we're here approaching the... we're right at the 50th anniversary of the conclusion of World War II. And so the 50th anniversary of many of the events connected with the final year of World War II, we're in the process of passing through those anniversary dates. And focus has been given to the very famous picture that sort of came to personify World War II of the Marines and who were raising the flag there on Iwo Jima. And you've seen the flag, you've seen the picture many times. You know, why were they raising a flag? Well, that symbolized their control. People could look at that sign and they knew this is ours. That's why always in war the being able to see the colors, being able to see that sign. It was always something that troops were after, to capture the flag, to capture the colors of the enemy, to pull down their sign and put up their own. Well, you know, just as there is a sign of obedience, as there is a sign that identifies those who obey the commandments, who know the God of creation, and who keep His commandments, there's also a sign, a brand, a mark, that is a mark of disobedience. And it's described here as well. You know, in Revelation 3, we read, as John was standing here on the sand of the sea, and he saw this creature come up out of the sea. And he describes this creature that he sees. And it is a very unusual looking... it is a very unusual looking creature that Daniel had also seen in Daniel chapter 7. He had seen four creatures come up out of the sea, different from one another. And he saw this appearance here of the lion and the bear, the four-headed leopard, as it mentions in Daniel 7:6, and then the final fourth beast, this dreadful and terrible creature with the iron teeth in Daniel 7 and verse 7, and it had 10 horns upon it. And there was a little horn that popped up there among those 10, had the first three of those 10 plucked up, and this little horn spoke great swelling things, and as we find on down further, that it was this little horn, as it describes in Daniel 7:25, would think to change times and laws. And it would speak great swelling words against the Most High and seek to wear out the saints of the Most High and think to change times and laws. So here we see this little horn described as a source of persecution for the true people of God. That it was a religious entity, it would seek to change times and laws. And it would also exercise political power, actually having the first three plucked up. Well, Daniel saw this coming up out of the sea, and he saw them as distinct creatures because they were empires that were yet to come. By the time John looked back on it in Revelation chapter 13, it is identified here as one system, as one creature. And yet all of the seven heads are there. And the ten horns are there, which, as Daniel 7 brings out, are upon the final head, the final seventh head. And it has the name of blasphemy written upon it. You see, and the creature that Daniel, or that John saw in Revelation 13, again, has the same characteristics. The leopard, the bear, the lion. All of these things are pictured. It's the same. It's a continuation. And we see in we see in Revelation chapter 3 and verse 2 that the real source of power and authority for this system was none other than the dragon. Now, the dragon, of course, is used as a symbol of Satan the devil. You can go to Revelation 12, verse 9, the great dragon, that old serpent called the devil and Satan. So here we have a satanic system, a satanic world-ruling system that was a continuation of the city that Nimrod built, a continuation of Babylon. That's why it's called Babylon the Great. Babylon the Great has reference religiously, but it also has reference economically, politically. The whole system is Babylon. Well, John saw the head wounded to death, and then he saw the deadly wound healed. Now, those were events that were yet future for John, because when John was writing, you see, this Roman Empire, and the Roman Empire had swallowed up the remains of the others. It was the successor state. And it was that final seventh head that was extant in John's day. And he saw it wounded to death, and then he saw the deadly wound healed. And he saw a continuation of that system. And, of course, that happened. Historically, the Roman Empire fell in 476 A.D., the end of the Roman Empire, and yet, a matter of less than 100 years later, the deadly wound was healed. Justinian from Constantinople, the Eastern Emperor, came in and restored the empire in the West, called the Imperial Restoration. Well, as we come on down here through Revelation chapter 13... we find that John describes in verse 11 another beast, another creature that came up out of the earth. Now, this is a system that originated, had an earthly origin as opposed to a heavenly origin. You know, the stone that smote the beast and destroyed it, smote the image and destroyed it, was something that came from heaven. It was of divine origin. But here we see another creature, a creature that is of earthly origin, and it has two horns. Now, horn is used as symbolic of power or authority. It has two horns, like a lamb, and spoke as a dragon. So here was a system that evidenced two forms of power or authority, two horns. It exercised civil power and civil authority as well as religious power. It was represented, it gave the appearance of a lamb, but really, the dragon, the devil. It was the devil's system, not Christ, but it gave the appearance. It claimed to be Christ. It claimed to represent Jesus Christ. Now, you know, there are all sorts of ideas that go around, and one thing that is very fundamental to understand, as we seek to have clarity in the events that are happening and to make sense of events in the world today, You know, there you can turn on television, and prophecy has become a popular focus for many religious speakers, and you find that there are all sorts of scenarios that are going around about events that are going to happen. And it's not a matter that certain specific things may not be correct, that this report or that report. There are various things that may, as an isolated event, be correct. But in terms of having an overview, no. You know, there are several things, and before I go on, let's stop and think about it. There are several things that are keys to understanding. If you don't understand these things, you can't make sense of the overall picture. You can focus on this or that or some other specific thing, but without some overall keys, you can't make sense of it. You know, the first starting point, what's the starting point? The starting point for understanding anything in the Bible is a humble, contrite spirit, right? You know, God resists the proud and He gives grace to the humble. We're told, to this man will I look, to him that is humble and of a contrite spirit and that trembles at my word. It talks about that the fear of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom. A good understanding of all they that do thy commandments. Psalm 111, verse 10. You see, a starting point is the fear of God, which includes an attitude of humility and it includes obedience. An obedient, humble attitude. The starting point for understanding the Bible is walking in the fear of God. A humble, teachable, obedient attitude. And as you... That's... Apart from that, while certain technical isolated facts may be able to be understood, and there are sometimes technical information that can come here or there, no one who does not walk in the fear of God can have an overview understanding of the Bible. Because God gives that sort of thing, that spiritual insight is tied in with the fear of God, with a reverent attitude. So, attitude and approach is a starting point. You know, God gives His Spirit to those that obey Him. The Scriptures have to be spiritually understood. Oh, I understand that there are technical things and technical bits of information that can be understood just simply by researching it. But in terms of fitting it all together and making it make sense. Now, then there are several other specific key things for prophecy. If you don't understand the identity of Israel, then you cannot understand any of the prophecies, virtually, of the Old Testament. You can't understand Isaiah, Jeremiah, Ezekiel, the minor prophets. All of these things that focus in on Israel, the time of Jacob's trouble. If you don't know who Israel is, then there is much of Old Testament prophecy that's closed to your understanding. You don't know what's going to happen to the United States if you don't know where the United States is identified in Bible prophecy. And, of course, most seek to apply everything that it says to about Israel. They seek to apply that to the Jewish nation in the Middle East. Well, there are prophecies that specifically apply to the Jews. You can go to the book of Zechariah and other places, but that's all the prophecies relating to Israel do not apply to there. They apply to the house of Israel. You know, another very key thing is the matter of understanding the role of obedience and disobedience tied in with the curses and the blessings. You know, that's a very key thing, that ultimately the wrath of God comes upon the children of disobedience. Realizing that the crucial issue centers around obedience to God and disobedience to God. You know, there are all sorts of, again, scenarios that come out that people lay claim to, and they focus on this and that. But you know, if you don't really understand the role of obedience, if you don't understand some of the symbols then that are here, the overview that is given in the Scriptures, you know, there is all sorts of some of the so-called religious right make a focus, focusing in on what they term New Age religion and all of this. Well, yeah, that's That's all well and good, and that's wrong, but I'll tell you what, old age religion is just as bad. You know, the old time Catholicism or Protestantism or Buddhism or any of the rest of it, you know, the old time is just as bad as the new time. I go back to the Middle Ages and read about the Spanish Inquisition. Christ said, many will come in my name, saying I'm the Christ, and deceive many. That's what he said in Matthew 24. You know, the final religious confusion, the final religious deception, acknowledges Jesus Christ as being the Messiah. That's not the argument. And anything else is just going to be marginal in the long run. That's not the issue. They pay lip service. You know, in words they acknowledge Him, but in deeds and in actions and works they deny Him. Christ said, not everyone that says unto me, Lord, Lord, will enter into the kingdom, but he that does the will of my Father which is in heaven. Why call you me Lord, Lord, and do not the things that I say? The issue comes down to obedience versus disobedience. It comes down to the commandments of God and the law of God. You see, that's something that virtually no one who comments on prophecy or world events understands, that the crucial issue. Who is God going to protect? Who is God going to take care of? Well, we're told in Revelation 14:12, here is the patience of the saints. Here are they that keep the commandments of God and the faith of Jesus Christ. Oh, that's the key. You've got to keep the commandments of Jesus Christ, the commandments of God and the faith of Jesus Christ. You can go all the way through, over and over, through the book of Revelation, and that is brought out. You know, that's what the book of Revelation ends up with. Where we're told in Revelation 22:14, right at the end of the book, blessed are they that do His commandments, that they may have the right to the tree of life and may enter in through the gates into the city. Obedience versus disobedience. Rebellion against God and yieldedness and submission to God and His laws. You know, this has been the issue from the beginning, all the way back to the book of Genesis. The issue has been obedience versus disobedience. And so in Revelation chapter 13, when we find this creature of earthly origin that manifests itself as the as representing Christ, the Lamb, but actually is speaking the devil's message. Verse 12 of Revelation 13, he exercises all the power of the first beast, the old Roman Empire, before it, and causes the earth and them that dwell upon the earth to worship the first beast, whose deadly wound was healed. You see, after the restoration of the Roman Empire, it was known as the Holy Roman Empire. The emperors, after the deadly wound was healed, were crowned by the Pope. You see, it was the first beast, it was the Roman Empire, but its deadly wound was healed. But there was a difference now. There was a different relationship that existed between the papacy and the empire. Now, the papacy demanded that everyone give their loyalty, their allegiance, their devotion to that system all the way down through the Middle Ages. We read in verse 13, and of course that's going to happen again, we read that he that does great, he does great wonders. You know, great miraculous things occur. You know, a lot of people are deceived by miracles, or what appear to be miracles. Lying wonders, as the Scripture terms it. Well, there's no reason to do that. You know, the key is back in Isaiah. We're told to the law and to the testimony. If they speak not according to this word, it's because there's no truth in them. You see, that's the key. And if you put everything to the test, is it according to? Does it agree with the Scriptures? Does it agree with the Bible? The Bible does not contradict itself. God does not send contradictory messages. You know, that's in Isaiah 8:20, to the law and to the testimony. They speak not according to this word, it's because there's no truth in them. See, the Bible doesn't contradict itself. Paul told the Galatians, he said, look, I don't care if an angel shows up and preaches some other gospel. Don't you believe it. There's only one true gospel. The gospel I preached, Paul says there in Galatians. He says, I marvel that you're so soon turned to another gospel, which is really not another. Well, I think we can understand that verse a little better these days than maybe what we could years ago. I've gone through the book of Galatians many times, and Bible studies and sermons and things like that, and that was always a little bit perplexing. But we realize that is not a case. That's not the case. So Paul, people can be quickly turned. You see, Paul said that in Galatians chapter 1, in verse 6. He talked about that you're soon removed. And he talks about if anybody comes and preaches another gospel, let him be accursed. There's only one true gospel. The gospel that Jesus Christ brought. The good news of the kingdom of God that he came into Galilee proclaiming after the arrest of John the Baptist. Now, there have been false gospels and there have been false messages and there have been all sorts of things. We see here in Revelation 13 that great wonders are going to be done. It's going to be impressive. And people will be deceived. They'll be deceived because they're looking to miracles. Well, you know, Pharaoh's magicians did a few. Simon Magus bewitched all the people of Samaria, giving out that himself was some great one. He worked great miraculous signs as they appeared to be. The Scripture talks about lying wonders. The real key is the message. So we find that people were deceived in Revelation 13:14 as a result of that. And they erected an image to the beast that had the deadly wound and they'd live. And of course, in the aftermath of the restoration of the Roman Empire, the papal system, which was modeled after the old Roman system in terms of government, in terms of structure, the whole structured system of the papacy was modeled right down to the T on the administrative governmental system of the Roman Empire. So an image was created, something that was that's what an image is. It's a model. They modeled this system after the old Babylonish Roman Empire. And then we find something else in verse 16 of Revelation 13. We find that the papacy, this second preacher here, the one that gave the appearance of Christ but actually spoke the devil's message, we find that he caused everyone, the important and the unimportant, the rich, the poor, everyone, all citizens, to receive a particular mark. Now, Mr. McGahey in the sermonette went through and told about what a mark, what a sign, what an ensign, what all of this is. It is an identifying measure. Required that everyone receive this mark, this sign, this brand, this ensign, this flag. Receive something, this identifying sign. He said, in their right hand and in their foreheads. Now, what's that talking about? You know, people come up with, they take this verse out of context and come up with all sorts of far-fetched scenarios. Well, you know, they're gonna tattoo something on your hand. Well, I want to just hold your place here. I want to show you something. Right here on the same page. At least in my Bible, in chapter 14 and verse 9, third angel followed them, saying with a loud voice, if any man worship the beast in his image and receive his mark in his forehead or in his hand, the same shall drink of the wine of the wrath of God, which is poured out without mixture. Now, you know, people come up with all these scenarios. Well, you know, they're going to tattoo a barcode on your hand. Why would God pour out His wrath on somebody that had some sort of a thing like that? You know, back when a lot of credit cards and plastic became real popular, people thought, well, you know, maybe that's the mark of the beast. Well, barcodes came out. There were people got upset about that. Way years ago, back in the 30s, there were people that thought the Social Security card, you know, the Social Security number, that was the mark of the beast. People come up with all these ideas. None of which have any connection whatsoever. You know, God's not going to pour out His wrath on somebody because they happen to have a Social Security card in their pocket. Why would God get so upset at that? Or, you know, you use plastic rather than paper, and everybody knows paper is much more righteous than plastic. Well, it makes no sense. Whether you're copying the numbers off by hand, you know, as I can remember, and you know, my dad ran a little country grocery store, and you remember, you know, the little, some of you remember the little, you know, little tablets that in the old stores where, you know, they'd write down what you bought and write the price out there, and when it was over with, write it all out by hand, you know, with a pencil or paper, and had the carbon paper in there, you know, and write it out and run the tab up on the adding machine, the old adding machine where you pull the, you know, you pull the lever. That's what he started out with, and that's what he ended up with. He was not one that felt the need to, you know, go with the flow. Is that far more righteous than running an electronic scanner over the little code that's printed on there? You know, is writing the numbers better? You know, God is going to burn you if you run it electronically, but if you write the numbers down, that's okay. You know, that has nothing to do with it. Who is it that the wrath of God is poured out on? Let's just hold your place here, and let's go back to the book of Colossians. Colossians chapter 3 and verse 6. See, verse 5 says, "Mortify therefore your members which are upon the earth, fornication, uncleanness, inordinate affection, evil desires, covetousness, which is idolatry, for which things sake the wrath of God comes on the children of disobedience." The wrath of God comes on the children of disobedience. Whatever the mark of the beast is, it is a mark, a brand of disobedience. Now, we just got through hearing about what is a sign of obedience. You know, the Sabbath, God says, is a sign between me and my people forever. It identifies. It identifies those who obey the Creator. Now, what about your head and your forehead, or your hand and your forehead? Well, Deuteronomy 6. "These are the commandments," verse 1, "the statutes, the judgments, which the Lord your God commanded to teach you, that you might do them." Verse 2, "that you might fear the Eternal your God, to keep all His statutes and His commandments, which I have commanded you." You are, verse 7, "to teach them diligently to your children, talk of them when you walk, when you lie down, when you rise up." Verse 8, "you shall bind them for a sign upon your hand, and they shall be as frontlets between your eyes, to be in your forehead and in your hand." Now, the Jews of Christ's day, by the time it came down to that, what they got out of it was they made a little box and they bound it around their head with leather thongs, you know, and they stuck a little, wrote out a few commandments, you know, just as small as they could write it, sort of wadded the paper up and stuck it in the box, and they thought they had really gotten the point. God said, "You shall wear them as frontlets." Now, anybody that's ever plowed a mule or a horse, you know what you have there? You don't want him looking off to the right or to the left. You know, they put blinders on them so that they look straight ahead. You could plow a straight furrow. You know, God's law is there so that we don't get off the track and go off to go off to one direction or another. It's there. It's in our forehead. It's like frontlets between our eyes to focus us on what's right in front, to walk in God's way. You know, your forehead and your hand, your hand, you bind it, you know, your hand, it's to be as a sign there in your hand. Your hand is what you do. Your mind, your forehead, is the seat of intellect. That's what you think. God's law was to be there, a sign of obedience. And the Sabbath, of course, was the identifying sign. It was the sign of obedience. And that doesn't mean you can obey that and disobey all the others. Because obviously, if you break one point, you've broken the whole law. James says that. But it's resides there in what we think and what we do. Deuteronomy 6 says that the law of God is therefore a sign. A sign of obedience, the wrath of God comes on the children of disobedience. And just as there is a sign of obedience, there is also a brand of disobedience, a counterfeit. Because you see, what did the papal system insist upon? Well, going all the way back to what is known as the Council of Laodicea, I think sort of an interesting name, the Council of Laodicea back in the 4th century, You know, the decree was issued that Christians shall not Judaize. By that they meant observe the Sabbath and the holy days. What were they to observe in its place? Well, they were to observe all the days of old Roman sun work. Why do they call it that? Well, that's because that's what the ancient Romans called it. It was the day of the sun. And of course the protector god of the Roman Empire was Sol Invictus, the invincible sun. That went all the way back to Babylon. Nimrod was identified with Baal, the sun god, the god of fire. That's why they used the fire, you know, when they passed their children through the fire, because fire was symbolic of the sun. You come down to all the pagan holidays, you can trace them all back. Most of all, we've studied into that, various ones of you. You know, you can look it up in the encyclopedia. You can look it up, and it all goes back. You see, ultimately it comes down, and there are events yet to unfold. And there is a warning yet to be given to this world. Because when these things come, it's not just going to blindside people. There is a work to be done, a warning. And ultimately, even after Israel goes into captivity, particularly the nations of Israel are going to be shaken and warned before this age ends, before the tribulation begins. The time of Jacob's trouble is not going to come upon the people of Jacob. It's not going to come upon the people of Israel unawares. They will know that there's been a prophet among them. And a warning is going to go out to the world, and frankly, even after in a very dramatic way, after the tribulation begins, because there are going to be two individuals, two witnesses there in Jerusalem, who will also have miraculous power, just as Moses and Aaron came to the court of Pharaoh, these two individuals coming there, and the power of God proclaiming this message. So it's not going to sneak up on everybody. No, you read in Revelation about what's called an innumerable multitude that comes out of the Great Tribulation, people of all nations and kindreds and tongues who hear this message and repent, and upon whom the wrath of God does not come. But those who are those who resist yielding to God, the children of disobedience, are going to have to receive something that really wakes them up and shakes them up. You know, God's not just going to sneak up and do it and do all of this to someone without them having any clue as to why it's happening. There are events that are building that will culminate. But we find here that this mark, this brand, it has economic impact. Verse 17, it's going to be hard. People, as they are faced with the truth of this, are going to have to make a decision. Because if they want to participate in the economic system, they're not going to be able to, they're going to be in a real bind. Because you see, if you run the week, do you realize in Europe they've already made a change in the calendar? It's interesting. I went through the French version Mr. Carrion did on the Sabbath, the day of rest. You have to explain it differently over there, because if a European calendars, all the European calendars start with Monday and end with Sunday. And, you know, that's just the way they print the calendar. So particularly, this has not always been the case, but it has been for a number of years. And so if a European picks up the calendar and says, well, Saturday's not the seventh day of the week, it's the sixth. Look, right here on the calendar. Now, you see a few of them that way over here, but it's not common. But they have officially renumbered the days in Europe. They can't. They think to change times and laws, but you know you can't. God set it in motion at creation. But he has to go through and explain that, take them back to some French encyclopedias that show that that was not the original numbering, and that was not the original reckoning, and how it was changed. But it's very confusing to people over there who assumed that Sunday was the seventh day of the week. Tell them you need to rest on the seventh day of the week. Well, you've got to prove to them which day is the seventh. Now, there are people over here who may be confused on that, but it's far easier to straighten out. But when you have a system set up that way, where the work week runs from Monday through Saturday, then if you're going to be able to hold a job, if you're going to be able to buy or sell, if you're going to be able to participate in the system, you're going to have to do it their way. Or you're going to have to rely on God. You know, there. I think that we come down here and we see that there are events that are building. These events will culminate in the things that are going to happen yet in the future. God has a warning and a witness to go out. A warning and a witness certainly to the house of Israel, because, you know, the message of the two witnesses will I won't say they won't be of any value, but they'll be certainly too late for the house of Israel that's in captivity. Because they're already in captivity. They're already in the tribulation. The two witnesses prophesy for the last 3.5 years. So, their message is not one of warning the house of Israel to repent or go into captivity. If it were, it'd be a little bit late. The Ezekiel message has to be presented prior to the tribulation. There remains a warning and a witness to come out of Babylon that is given all the way on up through the time when the beast power holds power over the earth. Some of those things certainly will continue. But you know, we live in a time when the temptation for many, you know, there are various things that can beset God's people. Some people have become deceived and have just, some of God's people have become deceived and have just totally gone into apostate teaching. And that's very sad. There are many others who have become burdened down with personal problems and just the cares of this life, have become discouraged and just sort of fallen by the wayside, overwhelmed by various things that maybe they are going through personally, or just simply the pressures and the difficulties. There are others who simply grow comfortable and self-focused. You know, we have to understand we have gone through the permissive 70s and through the self-focus, the complacent 80s and 90s, through a time when people have increasingly focused on comfort. People get comfortable and they don't want to have to do things that may be very uncomfortable. You know, it's interesting, in just a matter of a couple of weeks, the Jewish community is going to be observing a festival that is mentioned in the Scriptures that is not a part of the holy days of God, but it was a national time of celebration, and that is Purim, that is described there in the book of Esther. Now, you remember the story of Esther, a young Jewish girl who was taken by the Persian king who was chosen to become his queen. And of course, in the meantime, there was another story there, and that had to do with a man by the name of Haman the Agagite, who was aspiring to achieve great power in the Persian Empire, moved into the number two position. And Haman had a deep hatred of the Jews. And he managed to maneuver and to manipulate the situation so that ultimately he could get the king of Persia to issue a decree that would order a time of slaughter for all of the Jews. For all of the Jews. Everywhere. Well, this was the, as it says in Esther 3:13, the letters were sent by post to all the king's provinces to destroy, to kill, and to cause to perish all Jews, both young and old, little children and women, in one day. On the 13th day of the 12th month, the month Adar. Well, we find that Mordecai, Esther's uncle, or her cousin rather, was seen. There was great mourning among all the Jews, and Mordecai was seen there in the king's gate, and he was wearing sackcloth, and Esther couldn't figure out what this was all about, and she sent one of her messenger down to find out what was going on. And so he heard all of these things. And the Mordecai in Esther 4:8 gave a copy of the writing of the decree to be shown to Esther. And he asked her that she would go in to the king to make supplication. Well, when they brought this message in to Esther, she said, sent word back to Mordecai, and she said, well, look, I can't just go into the king. Somebody just walks into the king, why, they can be killed. You can't come into the king except you're bitten. I can get in a lot of trouble if I just walked in on the king. And so this message was repeated back to Mordecai in verse 12 of Esther 4. And in verse 13, Mordecai sent word back to Esther, and he said, look, don't think that you will escape in the king's house more than all the other Jews. If you altogether hold your peace at this time, then deliverance will come to the Jews from some other place. But you and your father's house will be destroyed, and who knows whether you're not come to this kingdom for such a time as this. You know, the first temptation that Esther had, she was comfortable. She was the queen. She enjoyed the luxury of the palace. Oh, there were difficulties, but it was a pretty comfortable life. To walk into the king in a situation like this and to try to get him to rescind something he'd already made an issue of, that was dangerous. That would be very uncomfortable. Mordecai made it plain to Esther. He said, look, if you value your comfort, if you say, look, I don't want to rock the boat, the most important thing to me is to be comfortable. Then you better realize God is going to get His work done. God will save His people. But you're going to be in serious trouble. And Esther realized that, and she said, will you gather all the Jews together here in Shushan and fast, and I'm going to fast, and then I'll go. The point to be made here is that if comfort is the thing that great value is attached to, things that are difficult, things that call for sacrifice, won't happen. There is a message that has to go forth. You know, Satan would like to deceive people. God's people like to deceive them and get them all tangled up, or to discourage them and have them overwhelmed with things. And if they can't do that, then to just be so comfortable but they don't want to bestir themselves to really finish the work. And that's what we have to understand. That's what our calling is. We've got to be focused on why we are called now. Mr. Armstrong used to emphasize that. You know, why are you called now ahead of time? God has called us now to participate in His work, to go forth with His message, and to be a part of those who will reign and rule with Christ when He returns. Our comfort cannot be the primary thing we value. You know, when you read back in Revelation 3, you read about the church at Laodicea, and they have a complacency. They're comfortable. They have no great desire to bestir themselves and to do something. The events that we've talked about in Daniel and in Revelation are real. They're very real. These things are going to come to pass. The stage is being set. All of these things that are going to come. And just as Esther bestirred herself on behalf of the people of God, so must we also. We live in difficult times, perilous times. Notice also that in the last days, perilous times shall come. That's what the Scripture tells us, and we must never lose sight of that. In the book of Proverbs, chapter 24, in verse 10, if you faint in the day of adversity, your strength is small. You know, in Daniel 11:32, we're told that the people that do know their God shall be strong and do great exploits. The people that do know their God shall be strong and do exploits. If you faint in the day of adversity, your strength is small. How are you going to have the strength? You know, the disciples on that final night of when Christ was taken, their strength was small and their strength failed them. They all fled. Why? Because they relied on their own strength. Brethren, if you rely on your strength and I rely on mine, we're going to fall flat. Our strength will fail and our strength will be small. But if we come to really know God and to walk with God and to drink in of God's strength, we will have the strength to deal with anything that may come. Those that know their God shall be strong and do great exploits. If you faint in the day of adversity, your strength is small. If you forbear to deliver them that are drawn unto death and those that are ready to be slain, if we hold back, lacking in zeal, focusing on comfort, being complacent, becoming self-focused, because then that's a serious matter. If you say, behold, we knew it not. We didn't realize it was so serious or so close. Does not he that ponders the heart consider it, and he that keeps your soul, does he not know it? Shall he not render to every man according to his works? We have a calling. We must never lose sight of what we have a chance to be a part of. As we see these events coming together on the world scene, we need to understand that the end is already declared from the very beginning. The Father has reserved the times and the seasons into His own power. Events are coming together and are culminating in the years ahead of us. And prior to that time, there is a work that must be done. We must work the works of Him that sent us while it is yet day. For the night comes when no man